Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the NOLA Drinks Show, friends, this week, as always. Yeah, got a good show coming up for you here today. We just completed Agave Week. And yeah, we're doing a show on mezcal, one of my favorite subjects. We're going to be joined by Brandon McCullers of Noble Coyote Mezcal, Evan Meeker of Del Maguey Mezcal, and Phil Minasali, who is with El Bujo Mezcal and also a local spirits broker. Three super knowledgeable guys on the topic of mezcal, agave distillates in general. We talk about sustainability. We talk about all kinds of really cool stuff in regards to the larger world of mezcal. So that's this week's show. Friends, want to mention a little programming note. Next week's show is going to be, yes, another installment, exciting installment of our French Quarter Fest series. We're loving doing that, friends. I hope you are enjoying it as well. We tape these at Louisiana Music Factory, and it's all in celebration of French Quarter Fest coming up April 11th through the 14th. So next week's show will feature Helen Gillet, the really interesting cellist, really brings in all kinds of different influences and genres, so not really even fair. We'll let her describe it. Listen to the show next week. As well as Derek Freeman, also a very diverse guy, leader of the Soul Brass Band, but done a whole host of other things. So that's going to be really cool. Looking forward to that. So again, French Quarter Fest series, friends, next weekend, Helen Gillet and Derek Freeman. A couple events that I want to flag to your attention if you're here in the New Orleans area or plan to be. Coming up this weekend, New Orleans Bourbon Festival, the third annual. That's right, March 20th through the 23rd. Stuff going on at the Hilton Riverside Hotel, Contemporary Arts Center. I believe that's where the grand tastings are. There's seminars, there's dinners, all kinds of things. So again, March 20th through the 23rd. Go check out NewOrleansBourbonFest.com for more information. There's still some tickets available here and there for certain things. We're going to be taping a show or two there. I'm really looking forward to it. It's one of my favorite festivals in town. This will be the third year we've been involved with it. Happy to be involved with it again this year. So be on the lookout for some future shows connected to New Orleans Bourbon Fest. But go check out NewOrleansBourbonFestival.com coming up this weekend. The following weekend, another fantastic event, friends, here. There is never a dearth of events, especially during festival season. And where we're at right now here in New Orleans, friends. But another great one next in 2 weeks or so thereabouts, depending on when you're listening, but March 29th and 30th, it's Hogs for the Cause. This is a great event. It's really, really run well. It's really a lot of fun. You have all kinds of different crews out there doing barbecue. Some are restaurants, some are just backyard groups, everything in between. There's great music both days, and it's for a great charitable cause. It benefits charities addressing pediatric brain cancer. It is one of my favorite events every year. It takes place at the UNO Lakefront, University of New Orleans Lakefront, out there kind of by their arena, and really just a fantastic event. So March 29th through the 30th, great charitable cause, Hogs for the Cause. Get out there and check that out. Some great food, great music, as I said, great drinks, and just a really cool crowd. It's always just really a lot of fun to be out there. Go check out hogsforthecause.org. Again, hogsforthecause.org, March 29th and 30th. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. When we come back, we're going to be back with our featured interview from Agave Week. Want to mention one thing really quick, too. So Top Taco, which was the grand tasting for Agave Week, got postponed due to weather. That was supposed to take place last Thursday. It will now take place May 16th. Tickets available for that. Visit toptaconola.com. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, and then we're going to come back and talk mezcal. Come on back. Get in the groove and let the good times roll. We're going to stay here. Everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, as always. Yeah, we're here celebrating Agave Week, which took place recently here in New Orleans. And today we're going to be talking about mezcal, pleased to be joined by three great guests. Evan Meeker of Del Maguey. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Second time you've been a victim of this show.
Yeah, that's all right. It was a lot of fun last time, so I figured let's do it again.
Yeah, we're keeping you for a little longer this time than one segment. Brandon McCullers from Noble Coyote. Brandon.
Hey, how are you?
Good, man. First time victim on this show.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, man. My pleasure. It's good to meet you in person last night, and good to have you on the show today, man.
For sure. Thank you.
And don't be shy there. Get up right up in there on the mic, Brandon. And Phil Minasalli, man, my friend here from PM Brokerage right here in New Orleans. How you doing, Phil?
I'm fantastic.
This is actually the first time you've been on the show personally, right?
I believe it is, yeah.
You just bring me talent, but this is the first time that you've actually been on.
That's it. In the nature of what I do is I try and find some unique products and bring them into the New Orleans or Louisiana market, and I always send them your way.
Yeah, that's always good, man. Well, and so you kind of gave us your background, so we'll start with you, Phil. So you... Your work as a broker, so you're identifying brands, help them get into the market here in New Orleans, and you've got some really cool mezcals. You're working with El Bujo Mezcal.
Right, exactly. So in the nature of like the brokerage element of things, it's the three-tiered system here, so it's like I obviously don't hold any inventory of the product myself, so really it's a sales consulting. I work with the brand to find them a home in Louisiana, and then, I either develop a retainer structure or commission structure on the work that I do. And, I brand build in the market.
That's it. Cool.
So one of those brands is El Bujo Mezcal.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first mezcal that I started to work with, and it really opened my whole world to agave.
Cool.
And what it is. So.
Yeah, we're going to taste that in a second.
Yeah.
So let's, Brandon. Noble Coyote, man. Pretty new, right? Is that correct?
Or? The brand's been around for about 7 years in Mexico.
Okay, not as new as I thought.
Yeah,
okay.
In Mexico. We've only been here in the U.S. for about a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
Rolled out in the Chicago market. And then since then, we've gone Florida, New York, California, Louisiana here, and a few other states. So just kind of getting rock and rolling here in the U.S.
Yeah, right on, man. So you're living in Mexico City, right?
Yeah, I've been in Mexico City for about 4 years.
Okay.
And I'm back and forth between the U.S. doing, just doing mezcal stuff, and it's nice. I spend a lot of time in Oaxaca and Mexico City and New Orleans and New York and Florida and everywhere else.
Yeah,
on the road a lot.
Costa Rica, man. We were talking about that before we went on the
air.
And Evan, Del Maguey, man.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, man. The time goes by really quickly when you're enjoying life and drinking mezcal, but I've been with the company 3.5 years now. Loving every day, humbled and honored every day. I recently moved to Tampa from Austin, Texas, so I've sort of kind of expanded out into the Florida territory, and just one day at a time. I don't get to spend as much time in Mexico as either of you gentlemen, but I cherish every bit that I get to go down there and learn even more from these amazing people who are making this amazing juice.
Well, tell us a little bit, and we'll bounce back this way in a second, but tell us a little bit about Del Maguey, man.
How
long has the brand been around?
The brand has been around since 95. And I pulled 1995. I pulled this Chichicapa from the collection of bottles that we had over there just to be sipping on, just because this was the first for Del Maguey. In a nutshell, Ron Cooper, an amazing artist, essentially went down to Oaxaca, I think it was the mid-80s and early 90s, to study art. A long story short, Mezcal found him, if you will. We have that saying that, you don't find
as
Mezcal, Mezcal finds
right,
you.
Right.
He recognized it, obviously being a visual artist, but also just being able to recognize art. And we still think of Del Maguey, we still think of Mezcal as art, liquid art in a bottle.
Yeah.
There's so much more to say, but I think, all three of us here can really agree with the beauty of the category in general when it's done in recognition of that beauty, right? And I really think Del Maguey as a brand just encompasses all of that.
Awesome. So, well, and we'll get into this further here. I just want to make sure everybody kind of, we know what everybody's all about. So Brandon, tell us a little bit further about Noble Coyote, man.
Like I mentioned, we've been around for about 7 years. We were founded by Bernardo Sada. He's a Mexican from Oaxaca, lives in Mexico City and Oaxaca between the two. He's a biologist, a botanist, and he has just fell in love with mezcal at a very young age. His family owns a very cool hotel right next to the Zocalo in downtown Oaxaca, so very deep roots in the Oaxacan community. Mm-hmm. And he's an amazing guy. He's really big into the sustainability and reforestation, and that's what he focuses a lot on now at the moment, actually, which we'll get into a little bit later, I have a feeling.
Yeah.
Like I said, the company was just being sold in Mexico, and we decided to come here to the U.S., and since then we've gotten into the EU and then Canada, so we're just kind of branching out outside of Mexico.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. And multiple expressions, same with Del McKay, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah, we work with 5 expressions right now mm-hmm. inside the U.S., a couple others in Mexico, but just a few expressions.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Phil, El Buho.
Yeah, to hone in on the artistic element that Evan was mentioning, this brand was founded by TJ Steele, a chef, so an artist in the culinary sense.
From where?
So he's out of Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
So his vision was to really hone in on Oaxacan cuisine. And, we just didn't have the resources at the time to have a restaurant. And he, of course, discovered being an industry person, spending time in Oaxaca, you drink the juice, you know, when you're down there. So he
it finds you.
Yes, mezcal found him. And he developed the idea of, why not build a mezcal brand? If I can't have a restaurant right away, let me bring something back up.
Okay.
And he found the Dinezik Palenque, and he connected with the Jimenez Mendez family. And now it's a single family distilled product, 5 generations, alembic pot still, really hones in on the sustainability factor, but has a lot of fun with it too. You know, it's we nerd out on mezcal, but we also want to bring it. Like they say, they want to bring the 3 cultural bees from Mexico: buena, bonito, and barato. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there you go. All right.
So
yeah, so good, pretty, and cheap.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
right. Awesome. And we could—I don't want to say paracho. All right, we're going to leave the 4th B out. But yeah, so actually, Phil, you kind of anticipated somewhere. Let's go in this direction because you mentioned this, and I think all of you guys, the brand, share the same thing. I know in your case, Evan, working with multiple families, so it's a very traditional beverage. Listeners on the show have heard us talk about mezcal before, so we don't have to dumb it down too much here. But it's a very traditional beverage that, and distillate, that's often made from family to family, meaning everybody has maybe a slightly different approach or they do different things. And it's a generational product. And
absolutely.
It's a culturally ingrained product, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. 100%. That was... My first trip to Oaxaca changed my life, and it was because as a recognition of what these families were doing, and you know, I was spirit educator for South Texas, when you're, you know, I came from bartending and bar management, pre that. But you get to see a lot of, you know, maybe small craft gin distilleries or whiskey distilleries, or you know, get taken around, and I thought I had an understanding of you know, cultural beverages and cultural spirits and small batch production until I went to Oaxaca for the first time.
It takes it to a new level. That's for sure.
Yeah, it really does. And seeing that. Having an understanding of terroir as well, which is what got me into, you know, when mezcal found me, I was studying to be a level 3 som.
Okay.
And then seeing all of this production in Oaxaca changed my life, and it just made me even more, you know, want to immerse myself in all that cultural. I mean, and please expand. I mean, there's so much to talk about culturally for this.
Without a doubt. And Brandon, let me throw your way, because like I know, for example, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Evan, but you guys work with different families, right?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Completely.
And do you guys do the same? Or?
We have 2 different palenques. We work in 2 different families. Marcus Brenneth, that's one of our families that we work with, and that's their make. 4 of the 5 agaves that we work with, the Jabali is made by Santiago, Don Santiago. Mm-hmm. And so we work with two different palenques, 2 different families. And the families are actually part owners in our company. So, you know, it's not like we're just coming in and buying mezcal from somebody. You know, they're partners in the company with us. You know, we makes it a lot more fun that way, having them part of it.
Sure, so, and that helps maintain the culture.
Exactly, and it makes them more comfortable with the fact that they're doing business with you. They don't feel like you're just coming in and buying the mezcal, sending it to the country, and making a bunch of money. You know, everybody always thinks that everybody's getting rich off everything that everybody does. They don't realize the hard work involved on the sales side just as much as it is the production of the mezcal. So The fact that they're partners and they get to go through the whole business side of it as well, it's good because, you know, they get to learn a little something new, and it keeps them involved.
Yeah,
so,
awesome. Yeah. Phil, I know you have...
Yeah, I mean, it really hones in on, like, the conversation of as the category growing. It's not a commodity. I mean, this is a culturally significant product, you know, and
a natural resource important product as well, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
And there's so much that comes into that conversation. But, yeah, when it comes to the relationship with your producer, it is paramount. The relationship is the most important thing of everything. People at El Buho, I mean, we're family at this point. Mm-hmm. So we stay at their houses.
Family's perfect word.
We have dinner with them, you know. We go to their kids' christenings. Like, it's like, this is, we are part of the family. I mean, and we have, they've helped us, of course, expand our cultural horizon, and we've helped them expand theirs, and they're bringing an incredible product to parts of the country and parts of the world that they didn't have access to before.
Okay. Yeah. Great. And I think you touched on something again, Phil, and for any of you guys, because of the way mezcal is so culturally ingrained, like you mentioned, the christening of children or anniversaries or birthdays or funerals or whatever, right? That this is a beverage. It's actually, you know, it's made locally by a family, and lots of times it's made and it's enjoyed locally within the family and the community. Correct? I mean, that's kind of the roots of it, is it not?
I'm
to a degree,
absolutely celebratory.
Yeah.
Kind of way in the pechuga style, right? I mean, for a really special occasion, it was making a pechuga, right? And It's, I mean, I equate it, you know, being a Texas boy as kind of to like, you know, family barbecue. You know, it's like, and then there's one, like, really awesome dude in your family that makes the best brisket out of everybody else, right? Well, he's in charge,
he's
right?
So the best
Uncle Charles,
you know, exactly. Well, the best mezcalero of the village makes the pechuga, and everybody comes together and celebrates, and that's kind of where it, you know, it stemmed from, you know, and I bet you there are a lot of other people that want to drink that would like to drink this as too. Okay, well, let's import it. You know, I mean, obviously there was a whole lot in between that
and there.
But
and it's not like a fake it till you make it kind of thing. I find with like mezcaleros kind of talking about what they do, it's like Jabali, for example, is like, some guys don't even want to mess with that.
The majority don't want to try it. I want to get into that.
You know, and they're just like, actually, you know, this guy over at this distillery, he can make your Jabali, but that's not my bag.
Well, Phil, do me a favor. We're going to take a little break here in just a second. Tell us what we have in our glass right now before we come back and...
Okay, sure. So actually, in what El Buho is doing, they're also bringing some contemporary element to it as well. So what we have here is we have a mango mezcal. But in the mindset of, like, as you mentioned, at Pechuga, this is two times distilled, Espadín. But then in the third distillation process, after the second distillation, they're just throwing all of the ripe mango breasts, if you will, mango breasts into the still, and the third distillation has like this nice aroma of mango and a little subtle mango flavor in the palate, and it's
really well integrated.
Yeah,
it's really nice. It's not overdone.
Yeah, and it's a nod to the old style, but also kind of bringing a fairly new approach to the style.
Awesome. So. Well, you guys, let's do this. We're going to take a little break here on the show, and we're going to come back. We're going to be talking more mezcal with Evan, Brandon, and Phil. Come on back, y'all.
See a little prayer in
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the NOLA Drink Show, friends, this week. As always, yep, we're talking mezcal during New Orleans Agave Week. And, Phil, we left off with the El Bujo Mango Mezcal. Briefly, just expand on what we were talking about during the break.
Oh, yeah. So, like I said, this is sort of new. It's going to be reminiscent of the styles of that pechuga being that, it doesn't have a protein. It's just, of course, just ripe mango mm-hmm. that's being thrown in to the still after a second distillation and then redistilled. So on the nose, I mean, you get some ripe mango, and then I think you get, like, a subtle mango across the palate and finishes with, like, some green peppery notes. And
yeah, it's nice. It's not too overpowerful. It's not overpowering at all. Yeah,
yeah, very well integrated, delicious, like we were talking about.
Very good.
Yeah.
So we were talking about, Phil, you mentioned that this is made from espadine. So espadine is a varietal of agave, which is what mezcal is made from. And, Brandon, we were talking about during the break that there's about 32 species of
agave. Right, around 30, 32 different. Of course, everybody knows the difference between mezcal and tequila. Tequila comes from blue agave. Mm-hmm. Mezcal can come from 32 other types of agave.
Right.
That's one of the main things.
So the point, take-home message here is all tequila is actually mezcal.
Exactly.
But not all mezcals are tequila.
It's tequila. Exactly. Absolutely.
You know, and we're finding more. I mean, this is expanding.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
I mean, it's not just set. I mean, 32 is a generalized number of what we think we're at right
there's
now.
There's so many more. Yeah. I was in Oaxaca a couple weeks ago, and I forget the name of the agave, but it was a spineless agave. Didn't have any. First time I'd ever seen it. And our mezcalero said, yeah, he says he makes mezcal from it on a very rare occasion when he finds it, but it was something that I've never tasted.
So something that's not cultivated, then he's kind of just finding it?
I assume so. He had one growing on his property that he was just showing us to show us what it was. And I was like, wow. And he goes, yeah, we've cooked with it many times, but it was nothing that I had personally tasted.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
So I think that this is an important distinction, too. So like we talk about espadine, which I believe is the most commonly used.
95% of all mezcals on the market are espadine.
Okay, got it. But then when we choose from the other 30 or so that we have, some of them are cultivated, and some of them are semi-cultivated, and some of them are not cultivated, correct?
Yeah, some are 100% wild.
Habali is 100% wild.
Yeah, Tobala, Tepestate, but not always the case with every single producer.
We grow our own Tobalas.
We
figured out how to do it.
You said that yesterday.
We do our own Tobalas. Mm-hmm. Not everybody thinks is a big believer. And growing Tobala, you should lose a little bit of the flavor complex as you do in the wild. But for reforestation, I mean, it's a great thing. You know, even if we start them in our greenhouse and then we move them back out into the, into the wild. We do some work with Tobala.
Evan, I'll throw it to you first. What is the difference then between, like Brandon just mentioned, that it changes the flavor profile potentially a little bit by cultivating versus not cultivating? Why do some work and some don't? And I mean, we don't need a whole botany lecture here, but
Ron would say only God plants Tobala, I really have to sort of look at this as kind of like, because you semi-wild, let's use semi-wild where it's not even cultivated Tobala, it's replanted back in the wild,
okay.
Right? And then you have 100% foraged, which is 100% wild agave. There's something special, maybe between the semi and the 100% wild. Maybe in terms of all these weird comparisons that we always like to use to explain stuff, but I say going out and catching your own Copper River salmon out of
that's
the
what I was, that's I was, what I was about to say as mean? Opposed to a farm raised salmon
as opposed
that's
to a farm raised yeah
I was gonna say seeing a shark at the zoo or at the aquarium seeing what actually
but the flavor the salmon was a perfect comparison.
There's just something a little bit special about that, but then it's you really, really need to get into the fact that if everybody starts foraging wild maguey and nobody starts considering the fact of maybe they need to take some of that wild seed and plant it on a nursery and then replant it in the wild, we're gonna have a big problem. We're not gonna, so that is on the forefront of a lot of things that we're talking about, at least I am in terms of the industry. We have one particular village, where most of our expressions are 100% wild, we're lucky in the fact that the producer there has such access to thousands of wild maguey around the area of his particular village, right? But we're also setting up a nursery. We don't even want to approach the, and it's things that I can't fully talk about right now, but we don't want to be put into a position where somebody can say, oh, well, Del Maguey isn't paying attention to this aspect. Well, no, we 100% are. And so
and we're going to get into the sustainability stuff in the podcast-only portion. But and tell, so tell people what Maguey means just so they know, because you're referring to it.
Maguey is adapted. I think it's actually of roots from Greece, I believe. But it's adapted Zapotec. It means agave.
It's what
So Del Maguey, the meaning is of the agave. But in Zapotec, it's what the producers,
it's
a
the
lot
local
of the producers
vernacular
refer to.
For agave.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Brandon, tell us, because we're chasing the Habali, which is this is
100% wild.
Three
distillations.
Okay.
And it's still comes in at about 51%. So okay. It's doesn't necessarily taste that warm, but it's to me, this is my favorite of one of my favorites of the agaves that we work with. I've always been a big fan of it. It's just very floral. It's on the nose, you can see it. It's like muddled roses.
it's very floral.
Yeah, it's extremely floral. And, this is one of, like I said, we have five different mezcals that we sell in bottle, four different agaves. So we have two different espadines. We have a tobalá, a coyote, which is a karwinski, and then the habali. So,
and I touched on it before, but why do people not want to mess with habali?
I was just going to ask the same thing.
It's very difficult to cook with. If you don't cook it exactly right, it can get very foamy in the process. Unlike most other agaves, if you cook with it and you're not necessarily know what you're doing very much, you're going to make a mezcal. It may not be a great mezcal, but you can cook 100 kilos of habali, and unless you know what you're doing, you can come up with zero juice.
Oh, wow.
So it's a very, very, very tedious process because it is such a strange agave to work
you
with.
Can actually
is it delicate then is that it,
well so there's an enzyme, it's called saponin, that's naturally occurring within the heart of and there's a much higher concentration within the varietals of habali of saponin. It foams so much that you can actually ruin your still.
Yeah.
So because if you don't monitor the temperature of the actual still correctly, it'll foam into the condensing coil, and then it totally gums that up, and then your still's done. Like
right.
you can't get it out. And
okay.
For somebody that relies on their one copper still,
they're not going to risk that.
It's generationally, right?
And you can compare
my
it.
My dad
to,
didn't do it. My grandfather didn't do it.
I'm not going to do it. And you can kind of compare it to craft breweries. Some craft breweries will not touch a sour beer because once you bring sour beer in those, when you bring that into your facility, then it's kind of tainted forever. You almost can't get rid of it. So, people stick to what they stick with. And, luckily this gentleman, Don Santiago, he's worked with Habali for a long time, learned it from his father, of course, and he makes an amazing product. And we love it and we love him. And, it's
fantastic. And I get this really pleasant kind of tart note to it, too, along with the floral. It's almost a sort of cooling kind of tart note. It was reminding me, we don't need to go down this road, but the Raicia,
which you
poured yesterday, had that kind of same minty kind of cucumbery tartish note to it.
Yeah, I'm getting like rose water, oranges, and like semi-sweet chocolate.
Mm-hmm. With this one.
Baking spice. In that order. Yeah. It's like, it's beautiful.
It's extremely floral. Yeah, and when you open the bottle, it's on the nose, it's definitely pretty amazing.
Well, you guys, we've got about a minute left before we're going to take a break. But, Brandon, on this one, since what we're talking about, then it's a wild cultivar, then you're not cultivating it. How much are you able to functionally produce, typically?
Well, the thing about habali is there's not really a problem with extinction in the near future. Okay. For one, just the way that it grows. It produces more of an offspring, more pups, and it's kind of more self-reproduces more than other agaves. Grows in nice large families, keeps its gene pool really strong. Okay. It's an amazing product. It's an amazing agave.
They got some wicked thorns on them, man. Like if you're not paying attention, like it'll just totally shred your arm.
Oh wow.
Habali means boar, right?
And yeah, wild boar.
And it's like to the tusks that come off and they're gnarled backwards. So if you like reach your hand in there and like pull it out the wrong way, like there you got some permanent marks from
the agave.
Oaxaca
tattoo.
Remind you not to do that again.
Yeah.
Well, you guys, we're going to take a little break here on the show. We're chatting, talking about Mezcal here with Evan, Brandon, and Phil. Come on back.
Mighty cootie fire, you on a mighty broad day.
We say Le Bon Temps Brûlé. Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Yeah, from the city that shares a deep connection to bourbon and knows how to throw a party, comes the third annual New Orleans Bourbon Festival from March 20th through the 23rd. Discover over 150 bourbons and American whiskeys, as well as great food at the Grand Tasting. Check out more than 30 seminars led by industry luminaries, special distiller dinners, and much more. The event is brought to you by Beam Suntory, Four Roses, Brown-Forman, Uncle Nearest, Bourbon Plus, and the Hilton Riverside. More info and tickets at nobourbonfest.com.
Now if you ever been down to New Orleans, then you can understand just what I mean. Now all through the week it's quiet as a mouse, but on Saturday night they go from house to house.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land wherever you may be. Yeah, it's Agave Week here in New Orleans. It was when you're hearing this. And now we're talking Mezcal, and please be joined by Evan of Del Maguey, Brandon of Noble Coyote, and Phil Minasali of PM Brokerage, who's representing El Bujo Mezcal here today. And you guys, we were talking about the 36 or so, 32 or so main varietals of agave that are used to make mezcal typically. And they have different maturation rates, right? So some will mature a little quicker than others. Some will mature much slower than others. And a lot of this is dependent on the species or the varietal, but then a lot of it is also dependent, as you were saying, Evan, during the break, on the terroir as well.
Yeah, terroir, and so maybe a little bit in the elevation, but primarily the soil. Soils, you know, generally at a higher elevation or denser, maybe more limestone, granite. You know, there are some varietals that really prefer the higher elevations, like, say, Tobala, that actually has an enzyme in its roots that will crack granite. So that's why you see them, like, growing out of cliff faces and such. You know, with denser soils and higher elevations, the agaves struggle a little bit more to reach full maturity, so it takes longer. Lower elevations, more fertile soils, they tend to mature quicker, which, you know, to me definitely has an effect on the flavor profile. You know, and I think that's a kind of a great leeway into Del Maguey and the whole concept of single village mezcal, into where is that we...
Hold that thought for one second,
yeah,
because I want to get a little further into the point, because Brandon, you made this point during the break that sort of like wine grapes, which a lot of people might be familiar with this phenomena, or weed, as we were saying, the plant actually needs to kind of to suffer a little bit, right? It's got to work for it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, just like you said, it needs to suffer in order to get a strong piña and to make good mezcal. Mm-hmm. I mean, plain and simple.
So what are some of the ranges then that we're looking at of maturation rates? Just, and I know it, because we've established here
from 7 to 35, or from 5 to 40 years. I mean, you know, you've got some pulqueros that take, you know, 25, 30 years, depending upon where they are. And, you know, you've got espadines that can be done in 5 years. So
yeah,
it's all over the board. I've seen mezcal grown at... are produced and agaves grown at sea level in Oaxaca up to, you know, like we were saying, up to, you know, over a mile and a half above, you know, above sea level.
Right.
So Mexico's a country of a very high altitude. You know, Mexico City's the highest big city in the world, you know, sitting at 8,000 square or 8,000 feet. And then, you know, get down to Oaxaca and it's a high area, mm-hmm. very high elevation.
And this, in Philadelphia, your thoughts on this too, because I think this is an important, really important distinction to make here. So we're talking about wine. We're talking mm-hmm. about a vintage, right? We're turning it over year after year.
Sure.
Even if we're talking about a lot of other distillates, or we're talking about, you know, grains being primarily used, we're still talking about most likely an annual cycle.
Yeah.
And in this
six
case,
months. Yeah.
Six
most right? most yeah. stuff is, you look at gin, rum, beer, whiskey, yep. vodka, everything is a plant that takes 6 months.
Yep.
And it continues to, you know, you can replace the soil, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
This stuff, it takes, you know, minimum 5 to 7 years. That's what makes it so special. That's what, you know, you want to, and that's the reason that I'm not a big believer in reposados, because you want to taste what the earth has given you.
Sure.
I mean, you know, this stuff has gone through 7 years of Oaxacan, you know, of Oaxacan weather. You may have two of those years may have been a really bad drought. They're having to pull extra hard at those rocks in order to sustain. You know, so it's, I think that...
Yeah, they're leaching what water they can, man. So it's like...
Yeah, you want to taste what the earth has given you. You know,
yeah,
you don't.
When you talk about those types of agaves, it's like, there's an honor behind consuming that towards
Absolutely.
The end, because, man, it fought. It fought to produce that quality.
I mean, for instance, the Coyote that we have, it's a Karwinski, and it grows in a predominantly a rocky soil, extremely rocky soil, and you can taste those mineral notes in the mezcal. It's extremely salty, dirty. Just it's a very, very different agave, different mezcal, just because of the soil that it grows in.
Mm-hmm. Evan, so we're let's move it into the single village mezcal stuff, because I think this relates to this.
It certainly does. The original four mezcals that, or I should say families, the producers that Ron started working with, are from four different villages, with four completely different climates and
different cooking methods, I imagine, and everything.
A couple are very similar, but then there are a couple that are very, very different from each other. I like to talk about the example of Chichicapa versus Santa Catarina Minas.
So we're tasting the Chichicapa now.
We're tasting Chichicapa, which are actually, they're both in the Central Valley. They're right next to each other, but then in terms of the hand of the maker, right? The producer that you're, the recipe that you're alluding to, Luis Carlos uses clay stills, Faustino uses copper stills, mm-hmm. But they're getting the agave from generally the same area, but their mezcals can be more different from one another. But then you look at, say, Chichicapa versus one of our OSVs, which is Santo Domingo Alboradas, which is way up in the mountains, where Central Valley, you're kind of desert, arid climate a little bit. Up in the mountains, you're actually in a tropical microclimate at 6,000 feet, 7,000 feet in elevation, with all these tropical fruits and chili peppers and pine trees and all these different ambient yeasts in the air. And then you taste Santo Domingo, and that couldn't be more different from the other. So it's the beauty of what makes it. Chichicapa, I guess I should say that, with Del Maguey, that when you're looking for an expression from us, because we actually have 18, which you asked us earlier, soon to be more in the States, from 12 different families. We've either named our expression after the village that it's made in the particular region, or we've named it after the varietal of the agave that it's been made from. Mm-hmm.
So there's a story of the provenance with each bottle.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important distinction here, too. Yeah. And I think, and I know I keep hearkening on this part, this sort of wine part of all this, because I think a lot of listeners out there are probably more familiar with the world of wine and how this all works. But there are so many similarities where the importance of terroir, the importance of style, like you're talking about, you could have a winemaker take the same set of grapes from the exact same vineyard, and it's going to come out differently. And I find, in my view, that mezcal is one of the highest levels of the expression of culture and terroir in a beverage. Pisco's up there, I think, in that category as well.
Course.
But I think it's something that it shows its sense of place more than almost anything out there.
Absolutely.
I don't think
we're done here, guys.
I don't think you're going to get an argument from anybody here on that.
I get about two moments like that on the show every year. It's like George Costanza, I'm out of here.
This is radio, but these are tears.
Let's do this because we got about 2 minutes left before I got to close out the radio portion of the show. You guys are sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Tell people where they can find El Buho.
Yeah, elbuhomezcal.com. If you're living in the New Orleans area, any of the bottle shops, were in 20 states, and you can find it how you can find it in your local neighborhood. We have a bottle finder, essentially, that'll give you the bars and the restaurants and all the package stores that sell our products.
So L-E-L and then newer Buho, B-U-H-O.
Yeah, B-U-H-O, Mezcal. Okay. MEZCAL.com.
Awesome, cool. And on all the Facebook interwebs,
yep.
And the gram and
At El Buho Mezcal.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Brandon, what about Noble Coyote, man?
NobleCoyote.com. Just go on the website and check us out, and there's links to take you to a couple of online avenues that we have that you can pick up some bottles throughout the U.S., I believe. And then, just go to online, check us out. Instagram as well, at Noble Coyote, and
And so we're going to talk about, in the podcast, the only thing, and I know you guys, with Evan, with Del Maguey, are big on this too, sustainability. I was looking at your sustainability page on your website. Cool stuff on there.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Evan, Del Maguey, man.
It's the same. It's our website, delmaguey.com, and that's DelMaguey.com. And essentially with us, what we do is we encourage you to email us, and then we will have somebody internally then send your email to somebody like myself or one of my counterparts, and we'll direct you to the stores in our territory that really have great selections. So. Also, our website does give detailed information on every single one of our expressions, the Vino de Mezcals and the original single villages, and even our two different styles of pechuga, the pechuga and the Iberico.
Awesome. So. Cool, friends. I want to encourage everybody out there to go explore the world of mezcal. It's really neat. As we were talking about, Brandon mentioned this, go with the clear stuff. Start with the clear stuff. It's like any good tequila. Anybody asks you if you want to try the tequila, taste the Blanco, because the Blanco is telling you what it's really all about, right?
For sure.
And the same thing goes with Mezcal as well. And there's all kinds of worlds you can branch off into as far as different agave species that are used in different techniques and so on and so forth. These guys are going to stick around for another shot with Noah Drinks. We're going to talk sustainability, culture, and some other cool stuff. So, friends, if you're listening on the radio, remember to be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all. Everybody, hey, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Noah Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you as always. Interesting conversation we are having with Brandon, Evan, and Phil talking Mezcal. As you know, one of my favorite spirits, not only because it's delicious most of the time, but it's also just absolutely fascinating, the culture behind it, the environment behind it, the ag, everything. It's just really just a compelling distillate. What we're going to do here is we're going to kick it right back over to Agave Week there at the Ace Hotel. Thanks again to them for hosting us while we did the show. And yeah, we're going to continue that conversation with those guys, talk a little bit more about production and the importance of educating the consumers and other people in the buying world, if you will, of Mezcal. Here we go. All right, everybody. Yep, another shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in, friends, this week. It is Agave Week here in New Orleans. If you're listening on the podcast, which this is really the only way you're going to be listening to it, actually, so I just kind of figured that out for you. I'm such a smart guy. I've had a few cups of copitas, I'm going to say, of Mezcal, even though they're plastic. We'll get into that, too, because we normally have these in a wood bowl, don't we? Like a little wood copitas.
Jicaras. Yeah, the copita is sort of like Ron's artistic adaptation of the jicara.
Okay.
You know, it's a smaller open-faced vessel for sipping mezcal. I loved it just because it only holds really 3/4 of an ounce. And so it doesn't, in my idea of it, if you will, it doesn't really allow for anybody to add anything to it but mezcal. It sort of forces you to drink the mezcal neat the way that it's intended.
And it opens it up.
It opens it up amazingly to the
aromatics, right?
And all that and
stuff. Well, we're kind of using this as a segue, right? This is sort of the traditional way to drink it. We've talked about in the previous segments the cultural importance of this to a degree, the environmental sensitivity to a degree of this. The sustainability issue, guys, is a big deal in all of this. We noted that the piñas take, in most cases, years and years and years to actually mature. They don't necessarily, you can't crank out tons per acre and all that kind of stuff like you can do with certain things. So being able to establish a situation where production can maintain itself and the way of life that is dependent on that production can maintain itself is a challenge, correct? And something that you guys as companies have
certainly
to actually face head on, I think.
Yeah, certainly do. It's a challenge. And I, everything that I've learned in this category over the past years, I really look at it as it takes an immense amount of work, but it's not so much that it, by no means is it not worth it, right? I mean, everybody can do it. They just have to be willing to. You know, and we can get into exactly what that is, but, you know, I think where they're, the people that are using very unsustainable practices are just doing it because they don't want to affect their bottom line.
Now, are we seeing, and I don't want to pick on anybody in particular, but I think we're kind of seeing that very commonly, at least I shouldn't say commonly, in certain instances in the tequila world with the blue agave, right? People are going about a production method, kind of maybe cutting some corners.
I mean, in any industrial, anything of that scale, yes, of course, corners are going to be cut, and the bottom line's the number one thing. So, mm-hmm. I mean, when these, you know, the mescaleros, when these gentlemen are making it, this is their heart and their pride, and this is their name behind it. So it's a little bit different than, you know, than a commercial tequila business for sure. Yeah, there's no question about that.
You know, it's I sort of think, especially with something that's so small in terms of the volume that's yield after, and it takes so much work, and it's that tradition, and it's that family's recipe, and it's the way they've been
and
doing
it's their name
for,
on it
for the, that long. The most important thing should be the sustainability of them. You know, right. I mean, like, because yeah. otherwise you can't. You know, you can't continue to have them making this juice, you know, that people fall in love with. So, I mean, there's many realms of sustainability. It's agricultural, it's social, it's economical. It's all of those things have to be
it's
considered.
Educational, like you said.
Educational,
that's a huge thing.
Absolutely.
A lot of people, families, let's say, may make, you know, all their mezcal out of 100% wild agaves, and they may think that, you know, they may have never left their little village. They think that, you know, Mexico's an enormous country, and, oh, you know, the mountains are filled with agaves. We're fine. We're only doing this little thing.
Right.
But if every single person's doing that, we're not going to have any wild agaves left. So, you know, it needs to be done. Collecting of seeds needs to happen. Germination needs to happen. Got to grow them for the first couple years in your greenhouse and then take them back and reforest or replant the forest.
Right.
It's what needs to be done.
Yeah.
It's what we do. You know, I have a feeling it's what these guys do as well. And, you know, it's something that we really, really believe in. You know, we go out and hunt seeds. We go out and hunt seeds, bring them back. We germinate them. You know, we plant them. We grow them until they're strong enough. You know, agaves need some love the first 12, 14, 16, 18, 24 months.
You have to let your fields flower.
Exactly.
I mean,
we need bees.
Yeah. And bats. And
bats.
Birds.
Bats are the larger the species that does more of the pollination.
And Phil, so your thoughts on that, and I think something that we touched on the panel that we did last night, and I don't want to sound, I don't know, trite with this, but, you know, mezcal should be expensive, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly ways that we can, you know, we can bring mezcal to, you know, to the consumer at affordable level. But when we talk about artisanal, like we are producing it like all of us are producing it, it's a method, and it's labor. It's intensive labor, you know. So you think about the sustainability. You're also thinking about the sustainability of those who produce it. I mean,
Absolutely.
The artisanal production, it requires a lot of sweat.
An immense amount of work.
An immense amount of work. You know,
back-breaking work, literally, yeah.
We are in this because we are passionate about it. We love the spirit. You know, it found us. And I think when you look at also the sustainability on my part, my time, it is an investment to talk to people about it. This isn't the type of product that I'm going to throw up on a billboard on I-10. You know? it's not, because when we
some
get
people
it,
have.
Yeah, some people
I'm not going to point any names out, but some people have.
Sure. But in terms of, you know, what I do, it's the education aspect to it. You know, we're in this. We love it. If there's any extra dollar that's coming in with these brands, it goes right back into sustainability. Into planting more agaves, putting more pups in the ground,
paying a living wage.
Maybe it's putting up solar panels at a palenque to you know, so maybe these guys can distill in the dark if they need to. I mean, it's
continuously
all, maybe
distill.
Maybe it's a setting. Maybe it's setting up or refurbishing a clinic in the village that's better, you know, for the overall health of the community that really, you know, has access to the land where you're growing all of the agave in that particular area. Yeah, so many things.
Putting an extra still in their house.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's what we've done.
And it's important too, because like you're talking about that like paying a living wage, paying a fair price to the farmer or the mescalero for the product.
That's why we've brought ours in as partners. They're actually shareholders in the company and own part of our company. So you know, I think that it just, you know, giving them a little stake in it, you know, makes them just, yeah, it's a good thing. So yeah, I think all those are very important. I mean, you know, you got to look at sustainability, even down to the trees that we're using to cook the mezcal. I mean, you know, there's not any trees in Waka, you know, so you have to look, these trees are coming from far away. You know, I mean, they're coming down from closer to the coast and, you know, up higher into the mountains. And it's just, you know, it's, there's a lot involved to it. And it's a lot more than just agaves and making mezcal. So
very much so. And I think, and I'm, as Phil's just said, I mean, everybody here is passionate about it. It's something I care a lot about. I was telling you, Brandon, I used to do coral reef work for a long time in the developing world, and being able to sustain the villages that are dependent on the coral reef in their neighborhood is incredibly important to the health of the ecosystem and anything that the fish and anything that's coming off the ecosystem. And I think we're talking about the same thing here in a big way. And it's a very complex problem because, well, let me ask you guys this question. To me, one of the most complex problems too is that, you know, I'm looking around the table and we're all pretty much gringos here, and we're dealing with the cultural integrity component of all of this. And that's a hard thing sometimes too, right?
Oh man.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
That was loaded question.
Yeah.
You know, my answer to that is well, one is that I don't really have one. I mean, because I can't. I don't necessarily think it's my place to speak. Right. But what I can say is that you know, I am humbled and honored every day to be out relaying this information, and I sort of feel like the better I can relay this information to people that would want to understand it and want to make purchases, that's helping the general overall cause.
Yeah, I mean, it's just we're a vessel, you know. Mm-hmm. It's in a vessel. We're bringing the education across to, you know, our people.
Yeah,
and we're sharing what we've learned. And of course, I mean, I wasn't raised in a mezcal producing family, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe some wine in Italy, you know, in Sicily.
This is, and thank you, because you guys, this is an important point that I wanted to make, is that when you, we're encouraging people in this episode here, and I do in general, I know you all do, of course, obviously, to go out and explore the world of mezcal. I want to make sure that people are understanding the cultural importance, the economic importance, the ecological importance of the beverage. As they enjoy, to me, it tells a story. It makes it even cooler. Like you were saying, Brandon, that's more special, but this is an important thing. Every time you take a sip or buy a bottle, understanding where it comes from, and maybe not necessarily, I don't want to bring it down just straight to straight numbers, but you know, I'll hear people complain, man, mezcal's so expensive. It's $100 a bottle or $120 a bottle for a pechuga. It needs to be that expensive, I would argue. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that? Or
Yeah, for sure. 100%. You know, some of the different agaves are a lot harder to come by, take a lot longer to mature, and the you know, mezcal is not easy to make. So it's a lot involved in the process. I mean, it's a very controlled government regulated and controlled substance. So, you know, any most places you get your liquor license to go ahead and make vodka. You make vodka and you make it and you sell it. This has to be regulated, the entire process, the entire stage. It's a different ballgame. It's a different ballgame.
Well, let's take a look at a number in terms of tequila. Because and at any given bottle of tequila, right? Maybe it's even somewhat industrialized. Okay, for an artisanal mezcal, you know, it takes a month and a half production. Month and a half
from once the pine has been harvested.
Yeah, we're not even talking about the time that it takes the agave to grow. Right. We're talking about the time you've harvested to it's actually coming off the still in your bottle. That's a month and a half. Okay, I could say maybe production for some large tequila companies. Very large tequila companies, it takes a matter of 18 hours. Mm-hmm. All right, so now let's look at a monetary stat. Any given bottle of 100% agave tequila generally costs, with the cost of agave right now in Jalisco, which I think is like $1.55 a kilo, something like mm-hmm. that, a liter is about $13. All right, so we're not, and that's before the U.S. You know, this is information, you know, a lot of which, you know, David Suro is very active in explaining this out. But this is before that the U.S. and the tier system of alcohol importation for the U.S. has taken any of their share.
This is not packaging. This is not shipping, right?
This is not the distributor's cut. This is alone the juice. This is how much it costs to make that. And that's incorporating even paying the magalleros, who work incredibly hard and probably don't get paid near enough.
Right.
Okay, so, and we're talking about Jalisco, and I'm talking about any given bottle. So this could be, imagine, industrialized 100% agave, all right? So you mentioned a couple hundred. I'm talking about, like, we really shouldn't be pouring, I mean, personally feeling that we really shouldn't be pouring bottles that are anything less than $20 a bottle, you know, to really think about that aspect. Or at least not complain about it. Right. You know what I mean?
Right. yeah, not that's my point. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Because as a broker that works the market and helps build the brand,
sure.
you got boots on the ground here working these markets.
Yeah.
And do you encounter, I know with a lot of the people that you work with that carry stuff, they're in tune with this. So
of course,
they get it.
Yeah,
but do you encounter some like, man, that's expensive. I love it, but too expensive.
Every once in a while, yeah, okay. Sure, that's going to happen. Oh, well, it needs to be here if you want it to be, you know, the cocktail price, you know, and it's, you know, and they
can't get there.
You just literally can't get there. You know, I'm like, let me see what I can do. There's always someone that will be willing to make that concession to get that placement.
Yeah,
and you know it, that's the fight that we fight.
That's the business. That's
the business. And I mean, really...
Well, it becomes
when it comes to the integrity of the production process, I implore anyone, if you're going to go and visit Oaxaca, write us an email, info@elbuomezcal.com. Like, mm-hmm. we will make time to, you know, talk to you, to send you, to meet Octavio, to meet Pepe Luyo, the people that actually distill
sure.
it.
Yeah.
Get in front of them, talk to them, because then when you have that experience, like... Maybe you're not going to complain so much about it being $4 or $5
and if you're buying
than what you're getting right now.
If you're buying it in Mexico, I mean, I was doing distribution in Mexico for a long time, so I've had to deal with the whole tax structure in Mexico. We can sell a bottle of Espadin in the U.S. for cheaper than you can sell it in Mexico because the Mexican taxes are so high.
Okay, right.
Mexico has to pay. It's a double taxation system, and they charge you 56%. Plus the 16% IVA that's on top of that. So it's actually kind of illegal the way they do it. They charge you the 56%, and then they charge you the 16% on the new amount that already has the 56.
Not the original amount.
Exactly. Not the original amount, but they charge the sales tax after they've already taxed you. So they're taxing on a tax, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's a handmade process. You know, we do ours with – there's no electricity used in the process. The only thing we use that was not in Mexico before the Spanish arrived are horses and metals. Other than that, is a pre-Hispanic process. You know, we bottle by hand still. We put the labels on by hand still. So, I mean, it's – yeah. I mean, you know, it needs to be the price that it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think for – an amazing Espadin to be on a shelf for $40, $45. I think there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever, you know. And I'm okay, you know, for a good Jabalí to be north of $100, $120. You know, that's where it needs to be. You know, it's with the difficulty it takes to produce the mezcal, with the difficulty it takes just to gather the agaves, everything. You know, I mean, it's not an easy process.
Yeah, that's important. Any final thoughts here?
Yeah. I mean, we're in the education business. You know, we're talking to people. We're in front of them. I see new mezcal hit the shelf all the time. You know, in a culture like here in New Orleans, it says a lot when there's someone behind it. When you can put a face behind the brand. You know, Brandon, you flew in yesterday. What was your flight? 3 a.m.
Yeah, I left the house at 4 a.m.
To be here.
It makes two of us, man.
Yeah, you know, to be here to talk about these brands and your passion and your love for it. And it's a testament to what we do and, you know, the integrity of the product. And I think that all ties into how special a product it is.
Absolutely. Any final thoughts there from you, Evan?
I mean, I think that was great final thought from all of us. It's, yeah, you know, just perfect. Really getting into that and you know, the little business aspect of it. And, you know, I it is my hope that moving forward, as this category continues to grow, that the general consumer really understands why these products are the price that they are, and that they're willing to pay for it, and you know, also want to ask these questions from people like us to help them even better understand it. Because, you know, as I always will say in a lot of classes that I do, it's the general consumer, right, that consumes, right? Obviously, why we you know, that's the name for it. But if they latch on to something that is taking advantage of the palenquero, that is undercutting all of these traditional spirits just so they can get their time on the back bar, you know, and if all of a sudden, you know, the masses decides that's what good mezcal is, well, then we're all screwed. Yeah. I mean, none of us will have a job, and the Palenqueros won't be making their mezcal anymore.
Way of life disappears.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
will you guys do me a favor? Circle back on the brands real quick, website and Facebook.
Yeah, absolutely. Delmagay.com. And just as I said on the radio show earlier, if you need you need some assistance in finding where you can go purchase it, just shoot us an email through the website, and one of us, myself or my counterparts, will get back to you on where in each respective market.
Awesome.
NobleCoyote.com, the same. Shoot us an email. Shoot us a DM message through Instagram. We'll get right back to you and let you know if we're in your market. If not, where you can find us online.
There you go. Cool. Phil?
Yeah, El Buho Mezcal, ELBUHO Mezcal.com. And yeah, like Evan said, we are we're here to help. We want to educate people on this and let them understand the importance and the cultural integrity behind mezcal. And yeah, info@elbuomezcal.com.
Awesome.
Shoot us a line.
Gents, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Brian, thank you for the time, man. It's
thank
appreciated.
You.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks. Yeah.
It's been great.
And the juice. The passion and the juice was all really good. Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude here, and I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. As always, I appreciate it very much. Quick programming note for you. As we noted at the top of the show, if I remember correctly, and I may not, next week's show is going to be an additional installment of our French Quarter Fest series. And yeah, looking forward to this one. We chat with Helen Gillet and Derek Freeman there at Louisiana Music Factory. Just taped that recently. Great conversation with those guys. French Quarter Fest is on our doorstep, friends, April 11th through the 14th. Be sure to check them out. Greatest music festival in the world, as far as I'm concerned. And yeah, as I mentioned, we taped that at Louisiana Music Factory. Go check them out, the greatest record store in the world. We'll have another episode of that coming up the week of French Quarter Fest, where we interview the famous musicians Paul Sanchez and John Boutte. Oh, yeah. And those two guys had a pretty special collaboration that you may recall featured prominently in the show, Tremé. Two really good guys. I've known Paul for a little while. I didn't really know John particularly well, but what a great guy. And we had a great conversation with them. And when we do the podcast only portion of that one, we get into the stories about how some of those songs in Tremé were actually written. Yeah, pretty cool stuff. I'd never heard a lot of what they were telling me. So pretty neat. That'll be in a couple weeks, 3 weeks or so. So be on the lookout for that. But yeah, friends, hey, it's our parting shot. Something inspired by Agave Week that we just wrapped up, as you noted. Thanks to those guys for hosting us when we just recorded this show. What I want to talk about here is, and it's inspired obviously by Agave Week and Mezcal, what we talked about here on the episode of the show. I had the great privilege of moderating three panels during Agave Week recently, and with industry experts, and a lot of good back and forth with people in the audience, a lot of service industry people, but certainly a lot of just enthusiasts as well, and some really good stuff. The first one was actually called Scotch Lover's Guide to Mezcal, and the idea was to take folks who are maybe into Scotch or broader world of whiskey, perhaps, and bridge some of those gaps between that and mezcal and draw some connections of, if you are a drinker of Scotch, how you might also really enjoy mezcal as you explore that world if you haven't. Really interesting. And I'll get back to that in a second. The other two that we did were called Farm to Bar. The first one was on sustainability, and the second one was on economics. A little bit of an overlap there, but the sustainability one emphasized, well, there you go, aspects of sustainability, ecological, cultural, so on and so forth. And then the economics one was a little bit more tied to production, cost of production. And we're talking about tequila and mezcal here in these, of course, and other agave distillates, actually.
But, you know, the idea there and the economics, so it's a little bit, you know, pricing and premium versus non-premium and things like that. Now, in my experience moderating panels, which I've done really probably most of my life in the liquor industry and other things as well in previous lives, there's always that guy, right? You always have that guy. And it's almost always a guy. It's hardly ever a gal, maybe once in a while, but almost always a guy who, you know, wants to steer the conversation in a certain direction, thinks he's the smartest guy in the room. Maybe sometimes, you know, likes like the retired doctor or attorney. No offense to doctors and attorneys, but you know who you are, if that's who I'm talking to. But there's in one of the panels, there was that guy. And my understanding is he's actually a retired doctor. So there you go. And one of the things that, and he had to be kind of reined in a couple different times, and I'll spare you the whole story, but I did ask people in these panels that they could ask a question or make a comment that was pointed to what we were talking about at the moment, and then there was going to be ample time at the end for sort of general Q&A and comments. And this guy immediately at the very beginning starts asking questions that are way off topic and so on and so forth. Yep, so you know what I mean, that guy. But one of the things that he mentioned was, well, you know, if agave is so fragile, meaning, you know, its production and so on and so forth, and there's a shortage and it's expensive and blah, 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 you know, you guys all said that we could grow it, you know, in many different places on the planet. Why don't we just grow it here in Louisiana and, you know, maybe make it better technology, blah, 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 solve the problem. Okay, guy, that's not how this works. There's a term that we all know pretty well in the spirits world, the wine world, and it really relates to a lot of other things. Terroir, of course, it's a French word, right, that means earth or dirt, literally. But what it means when we talk about, it's most commonly associated with wine, of course, is, you know, it means the overall ecology. It's the rainfall, it's the sunlight, it's the soil type, it's the temperature. It's the temperature swing over a 24-hour period, all of that good stuff. But an accepted part of terroir and its definition is the cultural and human component of it, a sense of place, if you will. And more we're starting to recognize the realities of what that means. In these places where these things like mezcal are produced, this cultural component is strong. People, as we talked about in the show, people enjoy mezcal. It's produced on a village level. Oftentimes it's produced by single families, and it's produced to enjoy for celebrations and, you know, birthdays and weddings and anniversaries and quinceañeras and all that kind of stuff. So it's culturally ingrained, and we talk about how production of agave distilling probably goes back well over 2,000 years. There's some evidence for that. The idea of sense of place is critical to terroir. Certainly you can grow agave in Louisiana, and certainly you can make a distillate from it, and maybe it would even be a very fine distillate if you did everything right, which is easier said than done. But, you know, I'm not taking anything away from that possibility, but I would argue firmly that if you do that, it is no longer mezcal. You can call it something else and feel free to go ahead and do it. Agave is grown in South Africa and it's distilled there. That is not mezcal. It doesn't have the cultural tradition behind it. The blood, sweat, and tears, and some of this actually matters. Now, there are those who would even argue that things like pheromones and neurobiology play into this. And so whenever you love your grandma's cooking, that there's a little bit of her in that cooking. And that's why it can never be, even if the same recipe is made by someone else, it's not replicated. Not going to go too far down the metaphysical road, or really, even if that's the truth, the neurobiological road. But I think that there is a huge value to the sense of place that is reflected in the bottle, the care, the tradition, using the same still for generations, the process that a particular family of distillers will use, what it means to be a mezcalero, the value of that, passing that on to future generations. All of that is displayed in the bottle when we taste this. This is why I think mezcal is such a special beverage, because outside of a few things, Pisco springs to mind, wine certainly springs to mind, and there are others, scotch, even that's why we talked about that on the panel a little bit, is that one of the things that scotch and mezcal share is that sense of place, that long-standing tradition, often family-driven, in producing the stuff. But that is reflected in the bottle, and you cannot take that out of the bottle. And that's part of when you go to enjoy it. And what I said is makes mezcal and some of these other things so special is that's part of the journey that we as drinkers of it, those who enjoy it, get to experience. And I want to encourage you as you explore mezcal, pisco, wine, any spirit, really any agricultural product, any art that's out there, anything, don't want to go too far down that road either. But think about where it came from. None of these things happen in a vacuum. And since they don't happen in a vacuum, they happen in a place. It is that sense of place that is reflected in the bottle. Once that is removed, it is no longer
that thing anymore. Mezcal, in my view, is no longer mezcal if it's not produced in that part of Mexico. Pisco is no longer pisco if it's produced, it's just basically brandy or eau de vie if it's produced outside of that particular area of Peru. A Bordeaux red is not a Bordeaux red unless it's made in Bordeaux, even if we're using the same grapes. And certainly, I mean, one can quite convincingly argue that the ecology is going to be somewhat different, period. But I, as you know here, I am emphasizing the human capital part of all of this, the cultural part of this, and the value that that has to society in which it's made and how that value is then reflected back into the bottle as these people make it. Please keep that firmly in mind when you enjoy these things, you explore the world of mezcal, and realize, as we talked about in the show, you should probably pay a little bit more for all these different reasons that we've touched on here in this particular episode. I'm kind of reminded by a saying, I know there's an adaptation of it just about everywhere, but we like to say it here in New Orleans from time to time. I've heard it more often than once and more often than 100 times. You can take the guy or the gal out of New Orleans, but you can't take New Orleans out of the guy or the gal. Same idea, huh, friends? That's our parting shot. Here's to you.